Welcome to Switzerland in Sound, produced and presented by Bob Zanotti.
Well, I just got off the train from Montreux. Montreux is the place that you have to go to make it up to Caux, either by road or by train. My favorite way to come here is by train. And we're up at 1,000 meters. That's 3,300 feet above sea level. I'm walking up to what's called Mountain House, a very appropriate name for an exquisite, superb, grandiose chateau, we could say, in the grand style. It was built just around 1900, 1902, I believe. And this is so impressive, especially down from Montreux. You look up and you see this perched on the side of a cliff. And from up here, we have the most beautiful view of the Lake of Geneva below and across France. And here, standing at the entrance, someone I've known for many years, Andrew Stellabrass. Andrew, nice to see you again.
Hi, nice to see you.
We are here to talk about what used to be called moral rearmament, MRA. It has a new name of, I think, about 2001 or 2002.
Right.
You changed the name, and now you call yourselves, the movement calls itself Initiatives of Change. We'll find out about the new name and maybe the new directions in a little while, but I always, Andrew, have been so impressed coming here to Mountain House. And this was actually, I mean, this has a tremendous history. And I believe it does go back to 1902, is that correct?
It does, but come on in out of the cold. It's just coming on to snow.
Okay, well, as we're recording, it still is late winter. This is almost a bit of a museum. It's called the Caux Expo.
That's right.
Which is one of the entrances. You have postcards and books. There's a library here. And there's an exhibition. And we see a lot of photographs of the past. And up on the wall here is a large photograph. I remember when I was up here before, I saw it. It says Groupe d'Oxford, the Oxford Group, which reminds us that, to use the old term, moral rearmament was an Anglo-American invention, really, wasn't it?
Yes, it was. It was started by an American called Frank Bookman in the 1920s, and he started working with the students at Oxford University. That's why it got the name the Oxford Group. And then in the late 1930s, as the European countries were rearming for war, he had this thought that what the world really needs now is a moral and spiritual rearmament.
Now, Frank Bookman was a pastor, wasn't he? He was a Lutheran.
He was an American Lutheran minister, but who'd had experience of the international evangelical movement, had worked in China, in India. So he had a very broad approach, and his starting point was really that people of faith and conviction shouldn't just live out their faith in their personal lives, but should, through the way they applied their faith in their daily lives, in their activities, in their professions, change the way the world went. And very quickly it became not just an ecumenical movement, but an interreligious movement. And we would now define ourselves today as quite clearly an interreligious movement that leaves space for people of no belief or agnostics or even atheists, but who share an ethical concern, a concern that ethics, values should be at the foundation of their lives, their decisions, and the way the world goes.
How did Oxford University come into this?
Well, it was just that Bookman started his work among students at Oxford University.
Was he teaching there, or
no,
was he studying?
No, he wasn't teaching or studying. He was just meeting friends, trying to pass on his own personal experience in a totally unofficial, informal, unorganized way.
Well, that's characteristic of the whole movement, isn't it, really?
Yes, we're a little bit more organized now than we used to be, but it's still very informal.
At the time, it would be a loose grouping, we could call it.
Yes. Nowadays, the sort of the in terminology is informal networks.
But is it correct to call moral rearmament really a religious movement, per se?
A spiritual movement, but not a church. I mean, it doesn't try and replace people's conviction. It tries to bring together people who share certain common values, to share those values, to encourage each other, but to bring about the needed changes that they see in the world. Mm-hmm. And if I look around the world, I can see one heck of a lot of things I'd like to see different.
Well, the building itself, to go back to the origins, just the facade here, which is a magnificent, classic hotel, grandiose hotel of the grand era of the Grand Tour. And how did it get into the hands of Moral Rearmament Initiatives of Change?
Well, this kind of hotel, this style of hotel, they were called the Palace Hotels.
Quite apt, I must say.
There are very few left that are still used as hotels. And the years of glory of the hotel were between 1902 when it opened and the beginning of the First World War in 1914. And I like to say that the jet set of the world before jets used to come here. There were grand dukes, maharajas. I found in the guest book Rockefeller, Kellogg, Gillette.
That says everything. Yes.
The rich and the grand, Rothschild.
They came up on the funicular. I did at the time.
They came up on the funicular
still
that you
running.
Came on. It's one of the, it's one of the first mountain railways. This was one of the first big hotels built at altitude, as you said. I think when you came up, 1,000 meters, built for occupation year round, built with double windows, double doors. It was a pioneer building in the Swiss tourist industry, but Caux, the village of Caux, was really at the beginnings of the winter tourist industry. The World Bobsleigh Federation was created here in the village. The World Ice Hockey Federation was created here in this village. But then the hotel fell on hard times with the 1930s, the economic crisis. It was used to house refugees in the Second World War, and at the end of the Second World War was in a very bad state. And a group of people, Swiss, who'd been involved in this Oxford Group moral rearmament, were looking for a place where they could create a conference center that would work for the reconciliation between the enemies of the war. And they found this place, and the women in the first group who came here thought, my God, how much work will be involved, how much cleaning, good heavens, it's much too big. The men were much more visionary and less realistic about the work that it would take.
It was on a volunteer basis even then.
It was on a volunteer basis then, and about 100 Swiss individuals and families put together their savings, their precious belongings, to buy this place and turn it into a center for reconciliation, in effect.
Going back further, what happened in 1914 to end the grand era of this hotel? Was it the First World War, as simple as that?
It was the First World War, and you can see from the account books and from the guest books how war is absolutely fatal to tourism as an industry. And you can see twice at the beginning of the First World War and the beginning of the Second World War how in the space of literally a week, 1 week, the hotel empties and all the staff are laid off. For the last 6 years now, we have a partnership between our initiatives of change, co-initiatives of change, and a hotel school. So as we go around the building now, it's not being used as a conference center today. It's being used as a hotel school, and there are about 400 students from all over the world, mostly Asia, who are learning the skills of hotel management.
So it brings in a bit of revenue then.
Exactly, yeah. And it allows us to look after the place better. And the end of June, we take over possession of the building, and July and August, we'll be having 6 weeks of conferences.
Beside that, Andrew, how is the movement financed?
It's financed by the giving of people who believe in it, and it has always been financed on that basis of personal giving. And the conferences here are partly financed by the contributions of the participants, the people who come for their to take part in the conferences.
Walking through what must have been the lobby at the time.
Yes, and it's still the lobby today.
Beautiful chandelier, wrought iron, with huge lamps hanging from a wooden ceiling. Didn't mean to interrupt you, but I just had to mention that.
And now we're coming into the Great Hall, which is absolutely empty at the moment.
This would be like almost a ballroom here, or a salon.
It was at the days of the hotel. This was the salon, the tea room. And to our right was the ballroom, in effect. On the same level, you walked into a massive ballroom, which Moriamt Initiatives of Change has turned into a theatre. So we now have this is really a self-contained conference center. Mm-hmm. And this hall, you can probably start to hear an echo now.
Yes, we hear the change in the acoustics.
And we're now under this massive dome with this fake medieval painting on the walls.
Almost like a parabolic dish effect here.
Exactly.
Refocusing the sound back down to us.
Well, this is, during our summer conferences, this is the conference hall, and this is where the actual conferences take place. There are simultaneous translation cabins behind us, so we can have translation into 6 different languages, or 8 different languages. And we're now in this bay window, which allows us to see the...
It's 180 degrees. It's a beautiful... Yeah. Reminds me of a control tower here, perched over the Lake of Geneva. We look down upon the lake. Montreux is down there, Vevey, all the way to Lausanne.
And almost
beautiful
Geneva.
Beautiful picture. Almost Geneva.
And we can also see the rest of the house, where we've got corridors that are about 90 meters long, nearly 100 yard corridors. And we have accommodation here in the house and in one or two other buildings in the village for about 550 people. We feel.
Do you get that many up here at one time?
Not too often. I mean, we're a little bit overcrowded when we're 550. We try to stay around 450 maximum during our 6 weeks of conferences, but we get about 2,000 people during 6 weeks of conferences with 4 or 5 different themes. So people don't come to take part in 6 weeks of conferences. They come for a 1 week conference on a theme that is close to their heart.
One thing I do have to mention as an aside, this is almost like a living museum. It's clean, it's beautiful, very well kept. But I have a feeling that it never changes. I can imagine that this is the way it looked 100 years ago.
Yes, it is probably the best preserved palace hotel in Switzerland, partly because we never had the money to ruin it as a voluntary organization.
It's a blessing in disguise.
Absolutely. And in fact, this is the original paintwork that you can see here around the fireplace. You've got the original tiles along the corridors and the floors. You have the original tiles. Most of the building has its original door handles, its original doors, its original window frames. And in fact, if you look at the old photographs from the hotel days, you can see that today we still use some of the same tables, some of the same chairs, the same silver on the tables, and even some of the same blankets on the beds.
All we need is a few people wearing the costumes of the day, and you feel as though you've been transformed back in time.
I smile because our movement is called Initiatives of Change. And
except Mountain House.
Exactly. Much here has not changed, and yet many ideas of change have gone out from here. Many people have experienced a change in their own hearts, in their own lives, in their own living, myself included, and have gone out from here with a fresh perspective on their work. To give you an example, one of the things that I'm very interested in, the continents I'm very interested in, is Africa. There was a group of young lawyers and others from Kenya. They have started about 5 years ago a clean elections campaign in Kenya, because they were living in a pseudo-democracy where a life president managed to rig the elections each time round, and they enlisted as many non-governmental organizations as they could, all the churches, all the different religious communities, to fight for clean elections. The first time round they failed, and the president managed to stay in power. A second time round, they managed to get rid of a corrupt president and a corrupt regime, and to really turn the country in the direction of a real democracy.
And this was one of the conferences. It traces back to right here, Mountain
Yes.
House and Co.
Yes, the people who started that clean elections movement found their inspiration here in Co, and then come back and share their experience to give other people encouragement. And I'm working in Geneva with a group of people partly from the Congo and the Democratic Republic of Congo, which, since democratic is in its name, as we can suspect, is probably not yet very democratic. And we're working out how we can play a part in a clean elections campaign in the Congo.
Let's continue discussing this and other issues as we walk back again under this the dome or the cupola, one could almost say. We hear the acoustics changing once again with an echo. It's a remarkable effect here indeed. Going back to accomplishments, if we want to start using that word, you've just mentioned some great results, concrete results, tangible results involving the continent of Africa. But if we go back again in the history of what at the time was moral rearmament, we cannot forget that the almost embryonic United States of Europe, that concept, it actually had its roots here, didn't it? This European concept of a pan-Europe, a united Europe.
We're not a political movement as such. So I wouldn't go as far as to say Coe played a part in building the European community, but I would say Coe played a part in reconciling the enemies of the war, of the Second World War, notably France and Germany, but also other enemies of Germany and Japan. And that work of reconciliation between the enemies of the war paved the way for a political agreement, a political solution. And I would say, if we look to the Middle East today and the conflicts of the Middle East, politicians will someday have to sit round a table and sign agreements, negotiated through long night sessions, no doubt. But before you can get to that point, there will have to be a critical mass of trust and understanding that is built between people.
And this is done during quiet discussions at a place like this?
Exactly. And this is where we see our specificity as a movement. It is that quiet work over many years, perhaps, of building trust and confidence, which perhaps can lead to peace. We've had a whole series of meetings here, confidential meetings, sometimes quite small, with people from Burundi, Rwanda, the region of the Great Lakes in Africa, a conflict which hasn't really made the headlines, but where experts say perhaps as many as 3 million people may have lost their lives, where terrible massacres have taken place, and where people from the different sides in that conflict who have very good reasons to hate the people the other side of the table have been able to at least start on that difficult work of building trust.
Well, this was the situation with the Germans and the French, of course, two arch enemies traditionally, who started quiet diplomacy, we call it today, right here at Mountain House.
Absolutely, and there's a phrase that resonates in me that we use here, which is healing the wounds of the past. So often we try to come to an agreement without having an adequate look at history.
You need a foundation, a solid foundation.
Yes, and people's hurts, their experience has to be recognized. One of the experiences that we've only been tangentially involved in is South Africa and the Truth and Reconciliation Commission there. But it's a very inspiring example where you feel that country could not find the reconciliation and the healing that it has found to a certain extent without recognizing the past, without talking about it, without forcing, pushing, encouraging people to be honest about what had really happened.
I also think of the former Yugoslavia.
Absolutely.
Still a delicate problem, which is wounds are not yet healed.
A very long way from it, and they haven't even yet set in place, as far as I can see, the mechanisms that would allow people to do that healing process, to talk about their experience, to I'm personally strongly in favor of the International Court of Justice in The Hague and for the fact that people are tried for their crimes. But that in itself will not be enough to bring the healing.
Any place on the earth, any place on the globe, and we have so many, where there is anger, there is hatred, there is warfare, this is the kind of situation where moral rearmament, then now called initiatives of change, tries to get actively involved. But exactly how do you do this? You have the conferences. Someone has to choose a topic to discuss here. You generate ideas. There's cross-fertilization, synergies. But how does the agenda come together?
Well, at the beginning of our talk, we talked about informal networks. Mm-hmm. Well, there are informal networks that prepare and run the different conferences that take place here, and bring together the people that they feel the need to bring together. Mm-hmm. At the end of our conferences, each year over the last years, in August, we've been having a series of meetings on a theme called the Agenda for Reconciliation, which really is this area of healing history, bringing together enemies, trying to bring about reconciliation. Well, there's a team of about, I don't know, it's hard to put numbers to it, I'd say probably about 50 people in the core team, several from the Middle East, several from Africa, several of them from these conflict situations themselves, who try to bring to CO the people that they feel could make a difference, are perhaps by their own personal suffering and experience ready to open themselves to a fresh way of doing things.
I know the Dalai Lama has been here and addressed people assembled at CO. Can you go down a short list of some of the distinguished, well-known people who have come up here, participated in meetings or as speakers?
Yes, the Dalai Lama has been here three times, I think, now. In those early years after the Second World War, Adenauer, the Chancellor of Germany, and Schuman, Foreign Minister and then Prime Minister of France, took part in meetings here. There's always a certain number of big known names. But I'm always a little bit resistant to journalists trying to discover lists of VIPs, because that labels us often in people's minds as a movement that's only interested in important people.
Elitist.
I would say, honestly, what I find most interesting about what I hear here, what I experience here, is the way ordinary people can become responsible for the situations where they live. The example I gave you from Africa, they're not prime ministers. They're a group of lawyers and fairly ordinary people who said, hell's teeth, it's our business to try and clean up our country.
Why did moral rearmament become initiatives of change?
The word moral can very easily sound moralizing, and rearmament is
holier than thou.
is definitely unpopular. Yeah. But that said, some of our friends in Africa, for example, feel that moral rearmament is exactly what their country needs now, and it's a phrase that for them still rings very loud and true.
I believe you'll find that in the continent of North America today, largely. You'll also find it among Europeans.
Yes, but again, I mean, North America, you've had the moral majority, and, you know, we don't want to be necessarily identified with them. So we had a long internal search for a new name, and well, out of that process of consultation came this new name of Initiatives of Change. Mm-hmm. Because there's a dialectic that the very heart of the movement is the idea that each of us can change, each of us can change our own way of living, our own values, our own way of living and acting. And that process of change sets in process changes around us. So that we take initiative because we've experienced change, and we bring about change in ourselves through taking initiatives as well.
We say again, though, moral and religious values in the best sense of the word, but you are not a religion. This isn't a cult. This isn't a sect here.
No, not at all. It tries to bring people together on some common foundation. Mm-hmm. That's not an easy thing to do. Myself, I'm a... define myself as a reformed Protestant, but Initiatives of Change offers me the opportunity to work together with Buddhists, Hindus, Muslims, and even with agnostics on the basis of common values that we share and a common belief that individual change, personal change, can help bring about change in the world.
What is a reformed Protestant?
Well, a Calvinist, if you like.
Very much at home, the
yes.
Calvin of Geneva.
Exactly. And the two pillars that unite us all in this movement is a belief in absolute moral standards of honesty, purity, selflessness, and love. And secondly, the idea that we can get inspiration from beyond ourselves, whether it's God, if we believe in God, or from our conscience, but that in times, regular times of quiet, we can find and receive inspiration, direction, correction from outside ourselves and beyond ourselves.
You're describing the essence of all great religion. They have it all in common.
Yes, I would agree with that. And I would say we don't try and rub out the differences between the different religions and faiths, but we try and find a common ground on which we can work together to build a better world.
Well, years ago it was reconciliation between France and Germany after the Second World War. You've mentioned former Yugoslavia, you've mentioned Africa. There are hot spots all over the world. Northern Ireland is another hot spot which you've dealt with here over the years. But today we're facing other things, especially since 9/11 in the United States. The concern about terrorism. But there are other issues. There are social issues. There are issues of so-called shareholder values versus human values. The problems that this has caused. Issues of globalization, which is a very emotional and sometimes even violent issue. What are you doing to discuss these issues?
Well, for many, many years now, there have also been business conferences here in Co, bringing together people from trade unions and management to try and deal exactly with these ethical issues of how we manage and our economy, our economic life together. During the Co-Conference for Business and Industry, for example, one of the highlights was a public confrontation debate between one of the leaders and founders of the World Economic Forum in Davos and one of the leaders of the founders of the World Social Forum in the Porto Alegre movement.
Economic Forum being the focal point and target of so much anger today.
Absolutely. And one of the thoughts that our current international president and Swiss president, Cornelio Sommaruga, the former head of the Red Cross, almost every time he speaks, he talks about globalizing responsibility.
And an economist, too. He was a roving ambassador with a portfolio in his department for economic affairs.
Absolutely. And I find this is a very interesting thought because globalization is, in a way, has been going on since the beginning of time. And a lot of it is an inexorable process that we cannot stop. But do we give it the right content? And I like this thought of globalizing responsibility because it puts some responsibility, at least, on each one of us, on the way we live, the things that we buy, the things that we decide not to buy, the way we travel. You traveled up here by train. Ecology is not just a great idea. It's the way each one of us decides to live.
It's not something that can be organized and imposed on people en masse. It has to be a grassroots, a very individual commitment.
Absolutely. And that's very much our starting point as a movement. It's that each person counts. Each person can have a part in building a better world.
I think this is an important point. You don't come up here and collectively wring your hands and hold your heads in your hands. You are activists. You want to do something. You're not passive. You are active in the sense of really generating ideas, generating schemes, generating plans and ideas and inspiration that will touch other people when the people who do come to Co go back home.
Yes, I'd say the most interesting thing about coming to Co and taking part in a conference here is the exchange of experience. So it's not hot air, it's not theory, it's hearing other people, like the example I gave you of these Africans from Kenya, how they actually set about changing the course of their country's history.
People with a first-hand experience.
Yes, and for instance, from the Lebanon, we've got a very interesting group of people who've over several years have shared from their experiences of working together between Christians and Muslims. For my money, this is one of the most interesting things in the world today, where so many people feel, who are non-Muslims, feel Islam is the problem and they're afraid of Islam. And here is a group of people, real practicing Muslims, real practicing Christians, who are working together for the healing and reconciliation of their country.
From Co, perched atop Montreux on the Lake of Geneva in western Switzerland, for Switzerland in Sound, this is Bob Zanotti.
If you want more information about Switzerland in Sound, check them out online at www.switzerlandinsound.com. Thank you.
on shortwave, AM, FM, the internet, and via satellite, this is PCJ Radio.